Hey guys, Max here with a couple of quick notes before we get started. The first thing is about the podcast format. So Pat and I have agreed before we started that we wanted this to be a 10-episode run. So each week we're going to have our phone call and we're going to talk to each other for an hour for the next 10 weeks. And it's going to end with a live panel at PAX where we tape the final episode. And we'll have the details of that pretty soon as the PAX Prime schedule comes out. The second thing I wanted to mention is the podcast name. It's still the untitled Patrick Rothfuss podcast this week. We're going to continue taking your suggestions. You can send those over to us at blog.patrickrothfuss.com. Hopefully we will close in on a name before the final week of the podcast.
Hello?
Hey, Pat.
Hey there.
How's it going?
Pretty good.
I read your AV Club interview.
Yeah, the recent one.
Yeah, the recent one where you revealed that you worked at Taco Bell.
Oh yeah,
and you operated a device that extruded ground beef like a caulk gun.
Actually, it was guacamole. Yeah, it was like a big caulk gun.
Yeah, that's really stuck with me ever since I read it.
It would stick with you even more if you had actually seen it done.
Oh, for some reason in my head, I thought it was the actual beef. So I'm comforted that it's a guacamole, because I was thinking a lot about how do you get a cow from being like the animal that you could, you know, go visit at a farm to being inside of a caulk gun.
Yeah, it's for some reason it is double icky if you consider doing that to some sort of animal protein. You know, I had a friend, this was way, way back in the day. He was a vegetarian, and they had done the 7-layer burrito at Taco Bell. This is how long ago it was, where this was a new thing. And he told me, he's like, you know, I know it's fast food, but, you know, it's so nice to have something I can eat as a vegetarian at one of these places. And I went to a different Taco Bell, and he goes, I could actually see them make it. And he hesitated, and I went, oh, you saw the guacamole gun, didn't you? Because, like, the truth is, the sour cream gun, it's okay. It kind of like you click it and it does like this dollop of sour cream, because sour cream has sort of like a consistency, like it's homogeneous. But guacamole is by its very nature, it's a composite of many different things and it's chunky. So when you squeeze it, it does not like smoothly extrude. It kind of like, it looks like an organic process that is not pleasant. Let's just say that. And it just like splatters this guacamole out in this irregular, violent stream. And it kind of ruined that for him. It spoiled the magic.
How old were you when you were working at a Taco Bell?
Oh, I was in college.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Was this part of a series of shitty jobs, or was this like the one that stands out as being the shitty job?
Oh, you know, I didn't mind it at all. You know, it was a shit job by the very definition. You know, I didn't even work the line very much. You know, the posh position at Taco Bell, not even counting being a manager, is you work the register. The position of drive through is, you know, you got to be a pro to work drive through. And then there's the people that work the line. And then there's like the true bottom rungers that effectively take, you know, they'll come in for a little bit over the lunch rush, and they're the ones that like clean up the dining room and mop the floors and kind of do whatever. We clean the bathrooms, and that was me, you know, for the most part. But you know, it wasn't a bad job. I've mopped floors and cleaned bathrooms in a lot of places.
This is blowing my mind. I had a lot of shitty jobs, but I never worked in a restaurant, and I never
really.
Well, now I work in, now I think it's fun to work in restaurants. So if I have a friend who, you know, will let me into their kitchen, I'll go, you know, cook for a night or go help out or just lurk because it's fun and interesting and I learn stuff. But no, I never had, that was, when I was growing up, I had summer jobs. I worked at the airport, stamping the cards of taxis. I sat in a little booth and stamped cards as they came through. I worked at wow. Radio Shack selling unnecessary appliances to old people.
But you know, Radio Shack, that's a hidden treasure of a job because you're just going to sort of organically absorb information working at a place with like technical gadgetry.
Yeah,
you know, did you?
No, yeah, you'd think that, but no. What I absorbed was that my manager at the Radio Shack used to tell me when you work in retail, there's no chairs. You're standing all day. And if there was nothing going on in the store, you'd collapse onto the counter. And my manager would go, time to lean, time to clean. And then we'd take a little picture of how the display shelves should look, like a Xerox, and we'd organize them so it looked like the picture. So you never really learned anything about the electronics except for how to organize them in the order that they were on the Xerox.
Oh, well, that's a bit of a shame. You know, the truth is I really enjoyed – I mean, I never went full bore into like the crazy job thing. It's like I was never a gravedigger. You know, I never – you know, never mind coal.
My favorite, when I was younger, my favorite author was this guy, Bruce Coville. Do you know him? He's like a YA author.
Doesn't ring a bell.
He wrote, My Teacher Was an Alien, and Aliens Stole My Ate My Homework or Stole My Homework. The AI Gang. Those were like big formative books for me growing up. And then the dust jacket of all his books, it had a list of all the weird jobs he worked. And the first one was Gravedigger.
I think I've seen that on, you know, and somebody's, you know, weird jobs I worked before I became an author thing too. See, that has a lot of credibility. If you have something like that's truly weird and eccentric and or menial. But, you know, I never quite reached that level. I mean, I worked at Shopko. That was my first kind of real job was toy department at Shopko. In high school.
You know, what's nice about that kind of job is you know when you're doing a good job because, like, you do exactly what you're told, and then if you do it, then you've succeeded. There's no ambiguity at the end of the day.
And I think about that, you know, a lot. Before that job, I worked at a place called the Prime Quarter, which is it's a grill your own steak restaurant. They have one in Madison, and
it's a grill your own steak restaurant.
It's actually a pretty cool thing because you have like these big pits and they put in charcoal and they light them up, and so you go in and you pick out your piece of meat and you hang out around this big open pit. And you like drink whatever booze of choice is, and you cook your meat, and then you go back to your table and you eat your steak. And now, admittedly, some people don't know what they're getting in there for, and they show up and they're like, "I'm supposed to cook my own food here. Isn't this America?" and that's what my job was. I actually cooked the steaks for the people that didn't want to cook their steaks. The problem is that I had no idea how to cook steaks. And I actually experienced something really strange for me. Normally I have a very sharp, learning curve. I can gain competency in something very, very quickly. But then with this one, I immediately went into a huge trough. So it's like they brought me in, they taught me how to cook these steaks. I'm like, okay, this is what you're looking out for. And then I was good at it for about 2 months, and then I progressively sucked at it more and more the longer I worked there, until eventually I pretty much I left, but nobody was sorry to see me go. And then I went to Shopko.
What were the secrets of making a great steak?
If I was better at knowing that, you know, I think – I don't know. It's probably the fact that I followed the rules when they told me. Like, if once the blood starts to come up out of the steak, once it starts to cook out of the steak, you know that you're approaching medium rare. You know, once – like when – like the juice stops coming out of the steak, you know it's done all the way through. It's well. I honestly can't remember. If I knew all of those things, I could probably still do that.
What do you do now? You extrude all your steak out of a caulk gun.
Yes. Now we have the technology to do that much more efficiently. But you're right. When I went to Shopko, it was like what was truly surprising to me, they go, here's your shift. Here's your orange smock. Here's, clean, if somebody asks you a question, help them. And by the way, here's the break room. And I'm like, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, for every 4 hours you work, you come here and you sit down for 15 minutes. You didn't take a break at the restaurant. It was just a ridiculous concept because when I wasn't cooking steaks, you needed to fill up the salad bar and you carried plates, but here they were saying, you come here and you sit in this room for 15 minutes. It's the rule. And I'm like, I'm going to get in trouble for dicking around if somebody catches me just sitting here. But they're like, no, this is the law. It was weird. It was like really weird to have to go and then take a half hour lunch. You punch out for it and just sit there and like just eat lunch.
When I worked at the airport, I had a similar experience of like they handed me my uniform and they were like, here's the thing that you're going to wear every day. And then when I got my first paycheck, it was like I made like $3 because the whole paycheck had gone to pay for the uniform that they gave me.
Oh,
and like that plus eating lunch every day, bringing lunch plus taking the bus and the train and everything to get to the airport every day. I don't think I may have been like a net negative for that whole summer that I worked.
it's sort of like, like what they do with the, it's not a work camp. It's the places where you get paid in scrip.
Oh, the mine, like a mine.
Like a mine or the migrant worker
right.
Things where like you can shop at the company store and you stay in the company housing.
This is how prisons work is they pay you, 5 cents an hour and then it costs $10 a minute to make a phone call.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually used to joke because, we do merch here and one of the things that's been steadily growing and necessitating me having employees is our online store. And so, we do things like we make t-shirts and everyone's like, I love these t-shirts, or we make a set of coins based in my world. And they're like, oh, these are cool. I want to buy some. And I joke. I'm like, all I really need to do is build an apartment complex and I can start running a factory town, I think is what it's called. I could start paying them in Rothbucks or something and they could use that to buy affordable meals in the canteen and as much merch as they can eat.
They'll use your fictional currency.
Oh, even better.
There you go, right?
Even better.
And then it's like if you need to control the like you're the Fed, but it's just whatever you write into the books. So if you're like, oh, turns out we got a bunch more coin, you just write that into the story.
Oh, I'm sorry. You desperately realize that it's going to be a bad quarter, and so you write a short story changing the conversion
right.
Between different currencies. Yeah, yeah, that would be a whole as if the regular, company town was not exploitative enough. You need to add a metafictional element to it. So here's something. As we've both worked, jobs which don't have a great deal of societal cachet. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
And now we both employ people. Do you think that has like changed the way that you think about employees and like how they should be treated? Or, what do you do? And I'm assuming you dealt with high level corporate fuckery there where it's like, come on in, work for us. Here's your uniform. By the way, we're charging you for it.
Oh, yeah.
So like that's just like corporate level, being a dick. But sometimes you get managers who are dicks or, you know, what do you do? Do you have things that you specifically do in order to avoid, you know, treating people like you were treated?
Yeah, I mean, I think we put a lot of work into making the office a good place to be, and not in the sense of the manipulative, like, startup Facebook way where they're trying to, like, trick people into staying there all the time. But we've tried to make it like a really functional space where you have a good balance of shared space and private space. You know, we have like healthy snacks and drinks and, I don't know, just, not, you know, office supplies when you need them. There's like, it's also a shared working space. So we have like a really good creative community. And I think the other thing is like, we just, I go so far out of my way to really only hire nice, friendly people who are, contribute to a good, you know, collaborative atmosphere. I think that's the biggest thing. The other thing is like, when we started hiring people and organizing, you know, cards and our other projects as like a company, the vast majority of my job experience was working on political campaigns. So it was really all I knew. So I set the company up like a political campaign where it's a very flat structure and everyone sort of is given tools to accomplish certain goals. You know where this comes from, the idea of like in the military, there's this idea, I think it's called like the tent commander, where the person in charge says to the field commander, you know, my intention is to take this hill. Go do what you need to accomplish that intention. And that's how we've tried to organize cards, where we have like a high level meeting and we sit down together and everyone says, you know, this is what we're trying to accomplish. And then everyone has the sort of tools and the authority they need to just go get it done.
That's really interesting for me to hear, because for a long time, you know, I mean, I came from, if anything, maybe the exact opposite thing, where, you know, I had never run anything. You know, and, you know, coming from, you know, it's my personal theory that, you know, in Wisconsin, especially if you're in small town Wisconsin, there's an incredibly different work ethic than probably in a lot of other parts of the country, because nobody is more than like two or three generations removed from working on a farm. Mm. And if you're and typically it's not like you're working on someone else's farm, you're working your farm. And when that happens, it's like you don't call an electrician. Like, you are the electrician, you figure that shit out. It's like, oh no, you know, the horse is sick. Well, you don't call somebody. I mean, you take care of that, you know. Oh, you know, my leg is caught in the thresher. Well, you know, rub some dirt on it because there's milking to do. And so, you know, I went from just kind of fiddling about and living my life and bumbling along. And then suddenly I was, you know, supposed to be writing professionally. And I'd accidentally picked up the job that all writers in this day and age tend to get along with being a published author, is you're in charge of your own publicity. You know, not that the publisher doesn't help. But if you're on Facebook, you're doing interviews, you know, I was working with my translators in 36 different countries. And plus, then I started World Builders. And so I ran all of that and I wrote all the blogs and I took all the pictures. And then I did everything. And then when I finally acknowledged the fact that I needed an assistant, we brought in an assistant. And so it was like just the two of us, and we all did everything. That's still a family farm mentality where everybody does what needs doing. And occasionally I would say, you do this particular task. And then they would do that particular task. And then I got more assistance and more assistance. But it was a really hard transition for me to slowly disentangle myself from the intricate doings of things, because I'm a fiddler and I'm a tweaker and I'm a fine tuner. And so I would want to be involved in a lot of the decision-making process, where, as you realize, you know, if you are doing a bunch of different things and you have a bunch of different employees, you simply cannot do that and still have any life for yourself. So, you know, it's I've finally gotten to the point where I'm kind of like a CEO where I say, like you said, take that hill, you know, and then they do it.
Yeah, I think I think about this is a very Midwestern thing. I think the what we're talking about of like this weird how weird it is, these like generational sort of job transitions that I think the people on the coasts have had more time to deal with. But like my grandfather was a factory worker in a pepper factory. And now I come into work and I like sit at a computer and I don't know. I like draw shapes in Photoshop all day and I get paid for that somehow. It's just such a weird contrast.
It is, you know, my girlfriend's mom was down in Colorado and they were doing some stuff there. And what she learned is if you're from Wisconsin, and again, this is all, you know, anecdotal, but she said, if you're from Wisconsin, you know, typically you get hired really easy anywhere else because there is this weird work ethic. That I really do firmly believe comes from the family farm mentality, where it's not just that you work as long as there's work to do, but you are responsible for anything that comes up and you never go to anyone for help. And I expect it's also – but it's much more far-reaching than that or maybe deep reaching. It penetrates the culture in an almost seismic way, because for ages, you know, I would tell people, you know, I mean, boy, have you talked to somebody about that? I would encourage people to seek out help or therapy or, you know, anything like that. But I never considered doing it for myself. Even though for a while I was studying to be a clinical psychologist. And it occurred to me, like finally when I went to therapy, I'm like, I sat down and this person started saying things and we started unpacking stuff together. And it was like a light went on in my head and I'm like, oh God, this is a skill. This person has a craft. They are, you know, this is a profession that is, you know, this person is doing incredibly intricate, skilled work that they are trained for, but I never considered going in and getting it for myself because, and again, I think it's this farm mentality. It's like if your hand gets caught in the thresher, you do go to the doctor, right? Because you need that hand. But if you're sad, it doesn't matter. You know, are you unhappy? Do you feel kind of a sense of ennui? Well, shit, I guess you better go actually plant the crop so we don't starve in a couple of months. It really doesn't matter at all in terms of your day-to-day life if you happen to be going through some stuff mentally, because the demands of farming life, you know, really, really flatten out that hierarchy of needs, you know, that Maslow's pyramid that they always show you in psychology.
Yeah. And the other piece of it, you know, that I think we were talking about a little bit before is like, you know, on the farm, there's an amount of work that needs to get done. And whether you're happy or sad, the crops will go bad if you don't do, I don't really know anything about farming. If you don't, I don't know, pick the crops. Is that what happens?
I'm pretty sure you winnow something.
Thank you.
You thresh at some point.
There's some threshing, and then anyway, at some point it ends up in the caulk gun getting extruded into a seven layer burrito. But you know, for the kind of work that we do, you know, where I don't know what you'd call it, like creative work or knowledge work or whatever, there's no clear boundary, right? Like you just keep working on something until it's abandoned or until you can't work on it anymore, and if you're unhappy and you don't have that drive and that creative push, it's a big fucking problem.
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit like what you talked about, where, you know, working at that job, it was kind of nice because you knew what you were supposed to do, and if you, you know, ticked every box, you knew you had done a good job, and then you go home, you know, and I would play D&D and goof off and until it was time to go to work again. Whereas, you know, like as a teacher, it was the first place I experienced it because I prided myself on, you know, all the way through college and through most of my adult life as having jobs which, you know, paid me a little money but required less work. I loved those jobs. You know, I worked in a computer lab where I would kind of answer people's questions and just make sure that people didn't steal shit. And it was great because like I would hang out and I would do my email and but I would also work on my book, you know, which was just a hobby at that point. It wasn't work. But then I became a teacher and suddenly there's always something that you should be doing. Where you need to you have lesson plans to get ready. You usually have grading to do. You know, no matter what, no matter how much you've done, there's always something else you can do that would improve your teaching. And it was such a radical shift. I mean, and it was okay for me because I was very passionate about teaching and I really loved teaching and I really cared about teaching. And that kept it from being excruciating. But it was still extraordinarily exhausting. I remember saying to somebody at one point in grad school, you know, I feel guilty taking a shit if I'm not reading a book at the same time. Because like that is time that is going to waste. I need to be reading some of this. You know, and a big chunk of that is not just teaching. It's also grad school, which is a whole separate level of hell.
Yeah, not to make it into too much of a first world problem kind of a thing. But I think people imagine that it's like, well, if you achieve, you know, if you work really hard at something and you achieve some success on your own, right? So if you're an author and you get a big book deal, you know, if you make a game and it's successful, that like suddenly you'll have all this time in your life and you'll have this great life of luxury and you'll get to do all this fun stuff. It's actually I found it to be like almost exactly the opposite of the more things are going well, and the more that it's growing and I take on responsibility, like the less I really let myself enjoy almost anything, because it's like when I go home and I try and just read a book or play a game for fun, it's like there's that voice in the back of my head that's like, man, you could be doing something right now. You could be answering some emails. And yeah. I'm just trying to like kind of train my brain and train myself to just be okay, like watching a TV show with my girlfriend and just being present and not, you know, trying to also answer emails on my phone or something like that. Which, you know, it should be this simple thing to just like enjoy life's pleasures. But there's always that little like, you know, gremlin in the back of your head going like, oh, you could be, this is time. You could be doing something right now. And that means the pressure on you must be unbelievable. Which, speaking of which, why aren't you working on the third book right now?
It is. Well, and I absolutely get where you're coming from there. And it's, you know, and when I moved from being a teacher to being a writer, it was absolutely a step in the wrong direction, because as a teacher, like when you would finish that stack of papers or you finish grading for the semester, it's done. You put that whole semester away and it's passed. And maybe if it didn't go as well as you liked, or maybe if you were late with the papers, or, you know, you screwed up a couple of times in the lecture and you didn't manage to bring the students everything you wanted to teach them, it was still that semester was done and you were going to start over fresh. And then summer came along, you know, and that was your time to regroup and you'd look at your lesson plans again. You'd kind of make another plan. But there were times, you know, it instead of like you punch out at 8 o'clock and you go home and you're free until you punch into Shopko again, there were end times at the end of the semester, at the end of the school year, where you were free. But as a writer, and as somebody who's running, like employing people and managing them and kind of overseeing a charity, and as somebody who's constantly doing kind of like product development and brand management. God, it just just saying brand management in any sort of serious way just sets my teeth on edge. Like, I know it's a game that I have to play, but like, it makes me feel like such a whore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to produce the content so that you can have a provide a positive brand engagement for your users. What?
I may have to, but I don't like it, you know?
Yeah. Doesn't that bug you when people call your work content?
I don't know if anyone has.
I guarantee you they have.
Oh, I mean, to my face.
Right. No, but in the world of games, this is a big problem. People are like, well, how much content are you going to put into this level or whatever? There's this great tweet by Jonathan Blow, the guy who made Braid, great game designer who made Braid. And it was after he saw the movie Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And he just tweeted, do you think Jiro ever thinks of the sushi that he makes as, quote, content?
You know, I as a geek of my particular flavor, I am a system manipulator. And that means I do find a certain joy in wringing the maximum result from any potential system that I encounter. And if that system is social media or the publishing industry or if there's a system or like any game, you know, it's in the game, a game is a system to kind of be manipulated. That I do that for fun, and it's a big part of my mindset. But you know, like if you are managing your social media presence, there is no end. There's no series of boxes you can check and then say, well, I guess I have finished social media for the day. It's a completely open-ended process, which makes it like a tar baby for me. As soon as I start engaging in one of these things, I want to maximize it, and it just kind of ends up consuming a piece of my brain. So, learning to distance myself and just take time to goof off and not constantly feel guilty while I'm doing it. I hear you. It's tricky.
This relates to another thing like we've talked together about a lot, which is like we both have a propensity for starting a lot of projects. Like whenever we see a problem or an opportunity, it's just like in our nature to be like, well, I could do that. Like I could do that better. I could solve that problem. Which is, I think it's part of that system manipulation thing, and it's part of that, you know, never being done feeling. Just from like a super high level, like I know you've got, you know, your writing and World Builders and this podcast and your family. Do you have a mental model or an approach of how you keep all that stuff separate and figure out how to spend your time?
No, absolutely not. I actually was just thinking about that this week, where a lot of people have budgets for money. I know how my parents kind of turned things around for themselves, where at some point they looked at how much money they spent on everything, and then they made a bunch of real conscious decisions about how their money was going to be spent. And so they actually, and this is kind of interesting, it might be useful for folks to hear, you know, those check boxes, this might be, you know, too arcane for some people. So there used to be things called checks, and you would get books of them, and they would come in little boxes that were perfect if you would want to put like cash money in. There used to be something called cash that people would use to purchase goods and services.
Before it was replaced by Pat Bucks.
Yes, Roth dollars.
Yeah.
So what they would do is they would get paid and they'd say, okay, this much money goes into food, this much money goes into entertainment. This is our car box where we pay for gas and automotive repairs. And everything else went to paying bills and paying off debt. And so, you know, like if we wanted to go to a movie, we took that out of the entertainment box. And if there was no more money in the entertainment box, then we stayed home. And I know it was a huge adjustment for them, but it kind of made them toe a line, and the family finances really profited from that. You know, at this point, I make enough money. I mean, here living in central Wisconsin where everything is cheap, and since I'm the sort of person who doesn't care about fast cars or buying clothes or eating, eating anything other than microwave burritos, you know, I'm fine for money. I don't have to worry about it. But I was thinking, what's truly precious to me and what I don't keep good track of is the hours in the day. And I was thinking, if I could somehow limit, look at what I spend my time on and say, you know, if I am on Twitter for more, you know, if I do email for more than 2 hours, that's more than my budgeted time for email, and I should not do that.
Boy, do I have a cool thing to tell you about.
What is it?
I'm going to hit you with a life hack. So I use a piece of software called Rescue Time. It is a kind of a web thing and a software thing. You can get it set up at rescuetime.com. And what it does is it's a little thing that runs on your computer, and it records everything you do on your computer, and it files it for you according to very intelligent sort of buckets, and then you can periodically go on and check on it. So, you know, I spend every waking minute in front of my computer doing things, and I have this image of myself as someone who, like, works in Photoshop and designs a lot. You know, I work in InDesign a lot, or I'm in a writing application writing, or I'm editing a spreadsheet. But Rescue Time tells no lies. It knows exactly what you do on the computer at all times, and I just pulled it up. So I can see that I've spent this is actually not bad. It's actually – I'm having a good year, to be honest. So 58% of my time on the computer is productive time, meaning I'm in a design program where I've spent 89 hours, or I'm doing communication and scheduling where I've spent 183 hours. And the remaining time is what it calls distracting time, where I'm on news. I have 121 hours on news and opinion sites, you know, Reddit, Tumblr, Medium, 114 hours on Twitter, Kickstarter, and 110 hours on YouTube, Netflix, playing Hearthstone and games. So I can see, so I have this image of myself as like doing all this creative work, but if I go on Rescue Time, it tells me that by far the number one thing I do on my computer is I'm in Gmail, where this year, you know, in the last 6 months, I spent 133 hours composing emails in Gmail. And the next biggest thing I've done is I've spent 98 hours on Twitter doing God knows what.
Well, especially you're not terribly, vociferous on Twitter. Is that the right word? Vociferous?
I think so. Why are you asking me?
I've been keeping a bit of an eye on your Twitter feed because I'm just stalking you in general, and that's a ton of time to spend on Twitter for as much as you don't chatter a lot, which I appreciate, by the way. I like people who tweet little on Twitter.
You know, you were talking about this idea of there's like an economy, like a budget, right? A budget of how you spend your money, and you're starting to think about your time as having a budget. I think about I'm very conscious of that the things that I say are a budget, and I want to be careful that I spend it on things that are considerate. So this started with a little trick from Merlin Mann, where I put a little text expander shortcut on my computer where if I type I believe it's IIDA on my keyboard, it auto expands to say I don't argue on the internet. So if someone says something provocative to me, I just type in IIDA and hit send, and it just goes back. And that just turned into not responding at all, And now I just don't spend my time having fights online, and my life is much happier, and I don't find that I'm any worse off for it. So I try to just say positive things. I try to not be negative, although I catch myself slipping sometimes. And then, you know, I try to make sure that if I say something, it matters, that it's a thing that I care that everyone has to hear.
Yeah, when I started Twitter, because I've only been on Twitter for about a year and a half now, and you know, but I've been on Facebook since the before times, you know, since long, long ago. And I've gotten to the point where I feel like I manage Facebook well. I make a post a day, and sometimes I miss a day, but I don't constantly troll it. You know, it actually, and this is interesting. The other day, my littlest kid, who is just starting to talk, his code name is Cutie, and he was sitting there and he grabs Sarah's phone and he goes, "Baby, baby, baby." And she goes, "Oh, he wants to look at babies on my phone. He's really into babies. He likes looking at other little kids." And so Sarah pulls up Facebook and she goes through her news feed. And it was so weird for me to see her news feed because I knew everyone on it. And like, there was a picture of somebody. I'm like, "Hey, I know that person." And then there was another picture. I'm like, "Hey, I know that person. What a weird coincidence." And then there was another, and I'm like, "Hey, I know that person too." And then it occurs to me that this is everyone else's experience of Twitter and Facebook, that they only have friends that are friends.
Oh, I get it, that they don't have just a legion of idiots constantly tweeting things at them that they have to exercise self-control to not reply to.
Right. Or if not self-control to not reply to, a great deal of care and consideration in the manner in which you reply. But even just her Twitter feed, because like I added every damn person back in the day. I've had 5,000 Facebook friends for the last 6 years, before I even launched off and did the fan page, which is where I do all my tweeting now. But my feed is still based off those 5,000 friends. You know, less than a percentage point of are people whom I actually know. And it's very similar, you know, like if I see who @s me in on Twitter, you know, maybe 10% is a good day of people who have been talking to me on Twitter, people I know, colleagues and writers and whatever. But most of those people are colleagues and writers and folks like that. They're not my actual like real world friends, like people who I have known socially.
Mm.
So yeah, it's interesting. I realize I have only a dim perception of what Facebook and these other things are like for other people.
You know, when I graduated college, so Facebook came out the year that I started college. It became available to people not in the Ivy League the year that I started college. So, you know, I just graduated high school. Of course, I went on and I added, you know, everyone I knew from high school. I spent 4 years of college just reading the inane, just dreck, just nothing, just prattling that everyone had to say. You know, people I already had to pretend to like them in high school, and now I had to continue to have this facade of a relationship with them after high school. And I, you know, it was like I think it was the week that I was like graduating college, the last week of college. And I was like, you know, this is the rest of my life now. Is not only do I have to carry all this baggage of high school people I don't want to stay in touch with, but I've got all these like screwballs from college who I don't really want to stay in touch with. And I don't really have to maintain the like facade of a relationship with them either. And I just deleted my Facebook. I was like, what do I need? There's like nothing that occurs on this that by any remote, you know, definition of the word would constitute friendship. So I don't know, I just was like, I am really not getting anything out of this at all, and I just burned it to the ground, and I've never looked back.
I think that, you know, that is the wise choice. I've occasionally, because Facebook, like every time Facebook changes, it is never to the benefit of the people using it. Mm. And I will say that with, you know, a lot of assurance. And the problem is, it's not just that I've put a lot of time into it, you know, because I know that's a bad way to make decisions, to say, oh, you know, that's how you stay in bad relationships. You say, oh, we've been together forever. You know, I know Facebook hits me sometimes, but, you know, it's, you don't know what it's like when we're alone. But the thing is, at this point, I think I've got like 170,000 people following me there. And it's a big information distributor for me. And of course, it's not as good as an information distributor as it used to be, you know, even when I had fewer people following me, because they throttle everything back and they manipulate what shares to whom with the hope of making me pay for it.
Yeah, right. Hey, would you like to pay to boost this message of your feelings to your friends?
You know, here's the thing. Like Twitter, obviously, like these promoted tweets, you know, seem to be coming up with more and more frequency. So here, I already know how Twitter needs to make money, right? I have solved this problem for them. What you do, and this is why I am evil and should not be trusted with power, what you should do is effectively offer people an upgrade to their account where they can tweet an extra 5 characters. But no, here's the rapacious way you do it. What happens is, while you're Twittering, if it sees that you've gone over, what it would do is it would still offer you the tweet button,
mm-hmm.
but it would say tweet for this much extra. And it would just be like a penny a character. See? That's how you would do it. A penny a character, but it would escalate. So if it was like two characters, it'd be like 4 cents. And 3 characters, it'd be like 8 cents.
I don't even want to think about how easily I would pay for that.
It's you like, would. It's Everybody
very,
would.
It's very upsetting.
And they would make $1 billion fucking dollars. This is my idea, by the way, Twitter. And if you use it, you are evil, but you better cut me a fucking piece of the action. everybody would use it.
What if you charged people to comment on your blog? What if it was $1 to post a comment?
Oh, what if, forget, that's forget, a great idea.
Forget you. What if George R. R. Martin charged $1 to comment on his blog? All right, should we take care of a little business? We got some podcast business.
Yeah.
All right, did you or did you not get an alarm clock to replace using your phone?
You know, I did.
Okay.
I did.
Okay.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Here's the real question that I will encourage you to ask. And this reveals more about me than I in some ways I'm comfortable with.
Okay.
I got the clock.
Uh-huh.
I took it out of the box.
Okay.
It is on my bed.
Okay.
But it is not plugged in.
Oh, it's so close. You're so close to it's the, can I tell you what you did wrong? It's the key step. The one, it's 90% there.
That's still an A minus though. Like 90% is like, is pretty much there.
All right. I'm much in the same boat. It took me a long time to like get the thing out of the box and set it up. So I went on Amazon and I got the least repulsive clock design, digital clock, alarm clock design. I got the Zupuat 5.3-inch morning clock, low light sensor technology, light on backlight when detect low light, soft light that won't disturb the sleep, progressively louder, wakey alarm clock, wake you up softly dot color gray white model. That's the full title.
Mine was kind of black and ovoid.
Okay. Mine is white. Mine is white and it's a white glowing rectangle. But I have used it one time to wake up, And it was nice. It was kind of weird waking up to an alarm sound that I wasn't used to. And then I immediately walked into the other room to get my phone to still go on Twitter. So I still have some work to do.
Yeah, it sounds like our heads weren't really in the game there. I think if we are going to do these things, mm-hmm. I think we need to, you know, obviously public shame might not be enough mm-hmm. for us. Mm-hmm. We might need a system of consequences.
Okay. So like every time we don't do one, we have to give $100 to Scott Walker for president.
Oh my God. You're right. That's exactly what we have to do. Like, it has to be something like horrific.
I was just joking. That's too much.
Well, no, it would. I mean, I was just thinking, I could feel the switch flip in my head, you know, and I went, I'm going to plug in that alarm clock as soon as I.
All right. Is that our threat? I guarantee you, I will not fuck this up if that's the threat.
Yeah, let's. I think you hit on a. I was at a loss for what we could do. Mm-hmm. So do we effectively redo this one, or do we do it?
No, we got to add this. They pile up.
I agree. We have to add a new one. What is our new one?
All right. So I made a little note for myself here. So I think we talked about two things that are related. The first is making a time budget, sort of thinking about how to budget time appropriately. And the second thing was, like, in that budget, finding time to just enjoy something that's like a good life thing for yourself that's not, you know, and to not screw it up by stressing out about work. So I thought it would be interesting. You know, I think it would be kind of cool, like the way that the Rescue Time dashboard gives you just like buckets, right? Of like, I want to, you know, you spend this much time doing this category of thing, this percentage of time doing this category of thing. I thought it'd be interesting to both sort of make a, just sort of make a breakdown like that. And then we can talk about it next week of like, you know, if you're really designing your life, you want to spend some time every day, you know, with your family and some time every day reading and, you know, some time every day doing these things.
Yeah, I agree. I think I'm absolutely going to install that and start gathering some data. Is it going to track porn? I've just got to ask the question. I'm not going to ask you to cut this out of the thing. Is it going to tell me how much time I spend looking at porn?
It will. You can tell it like, don't pay attention to these websites. You can like blacklist your shameful websites. For me, it's how much time. It's how much time I spend looking at blogs that are just photos of hamburgers.
Unboxing videos, you know, like everybody has one of those guilty pleasures. Okay, so let's codify this because I don't want to get screwed on a technicality.
So you do the Rescue Time or not. I already do that once, so that's a freebie for me. But I think the thing to do is let's each make like a little, you know, it can just be a couple of notes, but just something to talk about next week that constitutes some way of thinking about budgeting your time. So it's like for me, I might think about it as a list of habits that I want to do every day or, you know, things that when I look back at my week, I'm like, I spent my time in a wise way.
Okay.
And the other thing we need to do, let's go through the names. I pulled out a few that I thought were interesting.
Okay.
So my dad texted me with the title, The Half Amateur Hour, which I kind of like.
I think somebody either suggested or it occurred to me that eponymous Rothfuss sounds like it's just such a gorgeous combination of words.
What does that mean? It means it's its own name or what? I'm trying to piece it together.
It took me forever to figure that out because they would always say the eponymously named album. Mm-hmm. And what that means is if it's like if you're the Dave Matthews Band, it means that Dave Matthews has effectively given his name to the band. Let me see. What are some of the other ones that I found here? We've got some author and that guy, you know.
Oh, you know what? I pulled that one out too. I love that one. Kihil suggested in a comment the title Passing Wind.
Yes.
I thought it was pretty good. Oh,
there was Bards Against Humanity.
No cards pun.
Oh, and then the better one is Bards Against the Monarchy because that ties in King Killer.
What about this one I pulled out? There's no way we're using it, but Roger P. suggested Cards Against Chondrian. How, am I saying that right, by the way? How do you say it?
I say Chondrian, but it's very legitimate. There's a couple words with separate fair pronunciation in the same way that, like, the word pecan can be pronounced a couple of different ways.
Some people, Blargetty in the comments said that he really liked the title Untitled Rothfuss. There was some support for keeping the title.
You know, I don't know. Do you want to try to land on one now, or should we just continue the discussion? Maybe this, like I said, it took me 2 months to name my second child.
Did I not
tell you that?
No, I did not know that.
It did. It took me 2 solid months.
Well, I guess, what does he care?
Exactly. You know, and how am I supposed to name a kid when I haven't even met him? I'm enjoying the discussion of title, and I'm pretty sure when we get the right one, we'll know it.
Okay. I'm going to put my vote in for pre-writing with Patrick Rothfuss.
Pre-writing is a strong contender. I also think, like, Procrastinators Incorporated.
You know, I love that one.
It's pretty strong.
And you know, when we get bored and we turn out being, like, late with the podcast and we can't get it together and we stop recording it and it just sort of falls by the wayside, people will be like, oh, yeah, makes sense.
Right. It gives us our escape hatch. You know, I had considered something like that. I considered running a Patreon, and I've considered, like, several Patreon accounts of different weirdnesses. But one of them would be you could come in and the amount you donated would authorize you for different levels of officially condoned bitching about waiting for book three. You know, it's like you can, you know, for like 50 cents, you get to tweet on Facebook or like on Twitter, but you can't at me in. For a dollar, you can at me in and be passive aggressive about your wait for book three.
Mm-hmm.
For $2, you can be downright insulting. You know, for $5, you can threaten physical violence. And then there'd be a level for like writing an entire blog post about how you've lost faith in me as a creator. And obviously I'm just rolling around in money and I've never respected the fans.
How much would you charge to speculate whether you'll die before the series is finished?
Oh yeah, that would be an add-on perk. It wouldn't be part of the normal.
That's what we call a premium reward.
Premium.